Thank you, John. You did all right. He told me he was nervous. I told him, well, I'll trade places with you. And my name is Bob Frey. I'm a grateful recovering member of the Worldwide Fellowship of the Al-Anon Family Groups. And I'm glad to be here, notwithstanding Michigan's disaster on the football field. I had a friend call me up last week and said, I don't know who's had it worse in the last couple of weeks, the Michigan football fans or the president. And I said, yeah, that's true. But I said, I think that the Michigan football fans will get over it a lot faster than what's happening to the president. But that's an outside issue. I'm glad to be here. As John said, I grew up in Michigan and not that far from here. In southern Michigan, closer to Detroit. But I have been the last couple of days, yesterday, and I was thinking of the times that I've been in or near South Bend as a child, and one always takes a trip down memory lane and thinks about that, and we think back. But I've learned that looking back we shouldn't learn from our past. But I never started to get recovered or started recovery until I found out that I was never going to have a better past. And many of us that reading was read this morning were victims. At least we allow ourselves to be victims. And I've also learned in this program that there are no victims, they're just volunteers. And I wanted to say that my home group is the men's number one group in Louisville, Kentucky, and we meet every Tuesday night. And if you're in Louisville on a Tuesday night, I'd like to welcome you. That group is, we have about 70 men on our phone list, and about between 40 and 50 usually show up on a Tuesday night. And even if a lady shows up, as one did Tuesday night, we welcome them too. We're all sick, and this is a family disease. And I often think that, especially when I'm speaking at a AA conference, I have an identity crisis. I feel like I should say, well, my name is Bob Frey, and through the grace of God in this program and people like you, I haven't found it necessary to manage, manipulate, and control since Easter Sunday of 1983. And that tells you my obsession is to manage, manipulate, and control. And that's the thing that got me into trouble, not only as a child, as an adult, and even today. I'm just a hair's breadth away from slipping back into that. We have our slips in Al-Anon. You can't smell them like you can with an alcoholic having a slip, but we have them, and it can be just as disastrous because we'll slip back into taking care of people. You know, that's what we do best, is take care of them. I've been married 3 times to 3 alcoholics. I have a perfect record. And, you know, we feel we're needed. In our sickness, we love alcoholics. It's exciting. And one of the fellows I sponsor says, I love to be around alcoholic women. He said, you can see it in their eyes. Their eyes just say, we need help. We need you. I said, well, yeah. I said, that'll get you in a lot of trouble. I said, that's what gets us in a lot of trouble, because we think we do a lot of things under the guise of helping. And one of those is that we deprive another person of the God-given right of success or failure. And we do that under the guise of helping people. And any time that you deprive another person of God-given right, you're depriving him. And even though you do it under the guise of helping, you deprive that person of God-given right of failure or success. And I had to learn that the hard way. Well, I should go back and start as my child. They say the boy is father of the man, and as I said, I grew up in a small town in southern Michigan. And at an early age, I was during the Second World War, and my brothers were off in the service, and we lived right next to this church, a lot like this church here with that dome up there. We used to laugh and say we went to the church with the dome because of the circle the devil couldn't corner is up there. One of the things that we did, we lived next to this church, and we took care of, my family took care of the church in return for the rent on the house that we lived in. And my brothers, before they went in the service, they would help take care of it, and it was wartime. And I, even though I was young, I would go into that church, and I would take care. My mother would come and help me do the janitorial work, but I did the firing. Early on a Sunday morning, I'd wander through a church, lot like this, and I'd come to the altar, and there'd be a little light there, and I'd get down on my knees, and I'd say, God, what do you, I believed in God. I've heard people who come to this program and they'd given up on God, and I never gave up on God, except that I sort of had God in a box, and I limited my God, because I would sit down, I would kneel down at the altar, and I'd say, God, what do you want me to do with my life? And I expected, you know, a Pauline light or a bolt out of the blue or something. During the Second World War, they were always talking about, getting religion in the foxhole or something like that. And I expected the God to tell me what to do with my life. Well, I didn't get any revelations there. And a miracle didn't happen. So what I got out of all of that experience was that I had to take care of myself. And that while God was busy taking care of all the other people in the world, that it was my job to take care of myself. And I became an agnostic because I limited my God. But all during growing up, I felt that it is my job to take care of myself. And you hear people say that God takes care of those who take care of themselves. I don't believe in that today. I believe that God takes care of us all. All we have to do is ask. But I grew up as a boy and got into high school, and as you might notice, I have a receding hairline, and it's all receded now. But as a boy, I loved to run around with the kids that were having a good time, and they were drinking beer and smoking and having a good time, and they'd get me to buy the beer. And I'd walk into these beer stores, and I'd put my head down so they'd see my bald spot, and I was scared to death. But I wanted so much to be accepted by these people, and although if they drank beer, I didn't particularly care for one way or another. If it did for me what it has done for a lot of people, I'd be an alcoholic today here rather than an Al-Anon. But I loved to be with those people. They were living on the edge. And I love that excitement. I saw a bumper sticker the other day that said, if you're not living on the edge, you're taking up too much space. I was there just having fun. And it was exciting. But at the same time, I kept trying to keep these people from falling over the edge. I was managing them and I was taking care of them. I'd go out and buy beer and booze for them. And go with them while I got drunk, and then I try to sober them up and take them home and make excuses for them and cover up. And I was practicing my Al-Anonism at an early age, but I loved to be around those people, but at the same time I was scared to death of some of the things they were doing and some of the consequences. Well, I grew up I was an overachiever in high school. I graduated third in my class and played football and was an all-A student and I was an Eagle Scout and just a straight arrow. And I felt that in my home, my father was a functional literate. He didn't read or write. And my mother had 1 year of college. And my mother grew up in Elwood, Indiana. And how she met my father, I do not know to this day. You know, we talk about the secrets in our life, and that was one of the secrets that was existing in my life, and I never knew how they met. And it was a strange relationship, but my father was very, he was very an angry man, as I look back on it today. And he was, he would swear a lot. He was never obscene, but he was very profane. And I felt, well, I had to try to keep, not rock the boat, and try to keep peace in the family so that when he would start yelling, my mother would start crying, and then I felt responsible for all of that. I felt that if I was just a better son and did more, I'd be okay. And I was trying to take care of that. I've come to understand that taking care of that, I was doing that more for myself, because that's the way we get our validity. I was like the Boy Scout taking a little lady across the street, and she said, well, I don't want to go across the street. And I'd say, well, you got to go across the street because I got to do my good deed for the day. And so it was a whirlwind in people's life. Even though they didn't want to get taken care of, I knew what they needed, and I could take care of them. Well, I got off to college, and I continued a lot of the same things that I was doing when I was a boy, managing, manipulating, controlling, and doing it under the guise of helping. And in college, after some time, I think about the time I became a senior in college, I thought, well, you know, the great American dream is to find a Miss Wright in your life and settle down, get married, and have your 2.2 children, and have the little white house with a rose trellis up the side and white fence, picket fence, and live happily ever after. And one day I walked into the student center, and there were three students there playing bridge, and they needed the fourth for bridge. And so I sat down. They invited me to be the fourth for bridge. And this is where I met my first wife. She was one of the participants in that card game. And she was skipping school, skipping class, was about ready to flunk out of school, and was just having a grand time partying and living it up. But didn't know how to study and was having her difficulties. And, well, this was right up my aisle. I could just take care of all of this situation. So we started dating, and I started showing her how to study and how to work the system and how to have fun and still stay in school. And so she prospered under that and under my guidance. And we carried on a relationship there for about 3 years, and I went off to law school. And after we both graduated, I graduated from law school and she graduated from undergraduate school, we got married and went off to Chicago, and we're going to live happily ever after. And it didn't work out that way. And eventually we had two little girls, and at that particular time, she had some problems. In those days, however, if you had a problem, I didn't know she had a problem drinking. In fact, at that particular time, she was a closet drinker, and I've come to understand what a closet drinker is, but today I didn't understand that. She told me her mother was an alcoholic, was a closet drinker. I never saw her mother drink, so I just figured her mother didn't have any problem. But in those days, I'd come home from work, and she'd have a martini for me when I came in before dinner. I thought that was nice, but in the middle of dinner, she'd fall asleep. I couldn't figure out what that problem was. Well, we were married for something. She went to the psychiatrist a lot, and I'd asked her what she talked to the psychiatrist about, and she says, well, if you're interested, call him up. Well, I wasn't about to call him up because I was afraid he'd tell me there was something wrong with me, and I knew there wasn't anything wrong with me. And I figured if she'd just do what I told her to do, she'd be all right, and then I'd be all right. You know, that's how we are. We think that if everybody else is right in our life, then we'll be okay. And I think they call that codependency, but we often look to another person to make us feel right. And if that other person feels right, then we feel right. It's almost as if their blood runs through our veins. And, you know, I used to wake up in the morning with my first two wives, and I'd ask them, I said, how do you feel? And if they told me they felt fine, then I had a great day because I felt fine. And if they told me they felt lousy, then I had a bad day because I felt I was responsible for that. Today I understand I'm not all that powerful in the lives of other people, but at that time I believed I was. Well, after about 13 years of marriage, and we had left Chicago and moved to Cincinnati, and we took a geographical cure, and I thought that was going to solve all his problems, and Things didn't change, and after 13 years, she went home to her mother. And she said, I'm not fit or I'm not capable of being a wife or a mother. And she said, just give me some money so I can go see my psychiatrist, and you can have the children. And so she left, and here I am with two daughters. One at that time was about 12, and an 8-year-old. And that was right up my alley, you know, because people would say, you poor man, how do you do it? And I'd say, oh, it's all right. You know, that's the Al-Anon salute. Oh. And I'd say, well, it's okay. I'm taking care of these. I used to get a lot of mileage on that one, you know, say, poor me, you know, I'm doing okay. I'm taking care of everything. And by this time, we'd moved to Louisville, and so I was just taking care of my daughters, and I had housekeepers coming in, and somebody told me to put an ad in the newspaper and want to get a full-time housekeeper. So this I did, and I had about 50 women answered this ad, and so I took my two daughters and we interviewed them all, and we had a little family conference to see who we would hire, and finally I hired this one lady. She was a nurse, and she had a 6-year-old daughter with her, and she just had the clothes on her back because she said her husband was an alcoholic, and he was stationed at Fort Knox, and they lived there in Louisville, and he had beaten her up the night before, and she'd escaped and found my ad and was willing to come to work for me. Well, I saved her, and we had a little family conference, and so we took her in as a housekeeper. And within a week, we were playing house. And we told our children that we were married at that particular time. I was still married. My divorce wasn't final, and she was in the middle of divorce. We were living together as husband and wife, and we told our children that we were married, and they didn't know the difference at that time, or I thought. But divorces came through, he eloped to southern Indiana and got married, and that was how that relationship started. And in that relationship, that was a crazy relationship too, and I tell some of these stories not to take the lady's inventory, but to show you how crazy that I was in that particular situation. Because she was a nurse, and she worked in chemical dependency, and I went to my first AA meeting with her because she had to take some clients there, and all I remember was a lot of smoke and a lot of coffee. Well, the coffee's still with us, and I'm glad the smoke is no longer with us. But in that first AA meeting I went to, there was a woman from Fort Knox that came down, and she was talking, and there were some of the things that I don't remember what she said, but I remember when she was talking about the feelings that I had, some of these feelings of loneliness and some of the feelings that I could recognize with. And you know, this disease that we have, this disease of alcoholism, is a family disease. And we suffer some of the same problems in that we talk about this being a disease of frozen feelings. And we don't feel, and that's the same way that both the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic feel, is I've come to understand that you just don't want to feel. You don't want to hurt. And so you block it all out. And in that relationship with that lady, there were a lot of crazy things happening. And one of the things that she did, she bought a gun. And I'm scared death of guns, but she felt she needed that to protect herself. And one night we're sitting on the couch, and she's cleaning her gun, and she's got it all out and everything. And I'm sitting alongside of her and trying to convince her in my very logical way why she does not need this gun. And in the middle of all this, she's cleaning everything, she took the gun, she pointed to my head, and she said, "Shut up. Talk about spiritual awakenings, you know." And I didn't know it, but she pointed the gun towards the ceiling, pulled a trigger, and it went off alongside of my head, and put a hole in the ceiling, and I wet my pants. And a year later, I found this gun, and I took it down and threw it in the Ohio River. And I just felt great about doing that, and I came back and told a friend of mine, and he said, "Well, why didn't you throw it in the river a year ago. And I said, whoa, I couldn't do that. I didn't want to hurt her feelings. You know, we don't want to do that. You know, and this is indicative of how we are. You know, we don't want to rock the boat. We don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. And in many cases, we do that in our own injury. And she did things like that. And one day she worked, as I said, as a nurse, and she would come back, and she had a mason jar full of different kinds of pills that she would take from patients or in the hospital. She also had a drug problem. And one night we were up in our bedroom talking about various things, the right to die and all that. And I went downstairs doing something. She was still drinking. I came back upstairs a little while later. And here she says, well, I've done it. And I says, done what? She says, I've taken my life. And all these pills were gone out of this mason jar. She had taken them all. And she says, I'm going to end it all. And I says, well, I got to call EMS. And she said, no, remember, you told me that everybody should have the right to die. And I said, yeah. I said, that's right. And I thought to myself, well, maybe this is the way it's all going to end. And maybe things are going to be okay. And I watched her eyes get glassy and her speech get slurred. And pretty soon she just laid down on the bed and passed out. And I laid down beside her. I said, well, I said, maybe this is the way it's going to happen. And so I laid there very peaceful, and I planned her funeral, and I planned what I was going to dress her in. I wrote her obituary, good obituary, and I said, well, what am I going to tell the children, the family, and all that? Where am I going to bury her and all this stuff? And I peacefully went to sleep. And about an hour I woke up and realized the insanity of all of this thing, and she was still breathing very, very catchy, and I got her up and got coffee and took her to the hospital and pumped her stomach out, and she was all right, thank God. But, you know, you talk about, even today, you talk about that story, and it seems insane. Well, it was insane. But it, at the time that I was going through it, it was so completely logical to me. And that's the sickness that comes from our illness. And then there were a couple other things that happened in the relationship, which I don't like to talk about. And that was in our relationship with her children. She told me somewhere along the line that I had to make a decision between my daughters and her. And she says, when you get married, you have to make an election between your children or me. And I don't like to talk about it because I made the election to take her. And she says, well, you got to move these children out of here. And I didn't want to move those children out of here. I love my children. And she says, you got to do something. Well, the oldest daughter was just getting out of high school, and she ran off and joined the Army. I can still see her with her little bag and going up the steps of the federal building there in Louisville to report for duty. And that broke my heart. I didn't want her to do that. And at the same time, my wife was telling me, you've got to get rid of these children. Well, I've tried to make amends to those girls today, and this oldest daughter, who is in the program of AA today, and when I tried to make amends to her, she told me, she said, well, I don't know what you're talking about, Dad, but the biggest amend that you could make for me is to continue to live the way you do today. She said, that I can understand, but I can't understand what you're talking about trying to make amends to us. The second daughter today is, she went off to school in Michigan and was out of the craziness. And as I look back to that, that was probably a godsend for her, because she, to the best of my knowledge, today she is not directly affected by this insidious disease. But today she's a PhD, and both her and her husband are professors at Auburn. And a couple of years ago, when she was in Boston, she called me up and she said, she's got two little boys, two little grandsons, and she said, at that time she was interviewing for this job at Auburn. She says, well, both she and her husband had to go down to Auburn to interview for the job, and she was up in Boston with her children. And she says, I don't feel comfortable with leaving the boys with anybody but a family member. She said, would you come and babysit? And I talked it over with Camille, and she said, well, she couldn't go. She says, why don't you go? She says, you know, this She says, you'll have a lot of fun. You may never get the opportunity to do this again. It's male bonding and all that stuff. So I went up there and for a week and took care of these two little boys and had quite a time. And on a Sunday, my daughter had given instructions where I should take them to Sunday school, and this I did. And I put them in the Sunday school class, and then I went into the sanctuary and I sat down, and all of the loneliness came back to me of some 25 years ago when I was raising my two daughters, and I used to do that on a Sunday. I would take them to Sunday school and I would go sit in the sanctuary. And I sat there and all the pain and loneliness of those years came back to me and I started crying. And the good thing about that crying only lasted about 20 seconds, and then all of a sudden it came to me, says, Bob, you don't live there anymore. And you don't have that pain anymore. And it stopped, and I recognized that I was glad that I had been there, but I'm glad that I'm not there today. And today I love my daughters, and I hope that incident that I went through with them at that time is healed, but I learned something from that. And then the other thing I don't like to talk about in that relationship with that second wife was the infidelities. Now, she was the one going out having affairs, and then she'd come back and tell me about it. And the first time she told me about it, I put my fist through a wall. You know, we have this so-called double standard, you know, that it's all right for the males to do this, but not for the females. And I don't believe it's right either way. But I, again, at that particular time when she came back and told me about those things, my first inclination was to throw her out, and then I said, well, that's my fault. That's not her fault. If I was just a better father, a better husband, a better lover, better anything, she wouldn't have to do that. And so I needed to work hard and to do the right things to take care of all of this. Well, today I understand it had nothing to do about me, but it had everything to do about her. But it took me a long time to understand that, because I felt that I was responsible for all of that. And finally I decided that I knew how to cure this. And so she was running around with this one girl, and I went to the woman she was running around with, and I propositioned her and took her on a business trip with me and seduced her. And I got home as fast as I could so I could run home and tell my wife what I had done. And I figured that would fix her. Well, it didn't, and if any of you out there got those ideas, don't. It's an outside issue. I was thinking, well, that's adultery, but our president doesn't recognize that either, so anyway, that's an outside issue. But going on from that, at one time, shortly after that, my wife announced to me that her daughter, who was living with us, was 16 at the time, she said, she's got to go to treatment, and she's an alcoholic. Well, I didn't know anything about it, but I figured, well, since she was working in the field, she would know. So she said, we can't send her here in Louisville, because she was working in a juvenile treatment center at that time. She said, we've got to send her to Chattanooga. So we shipped her off, took her down to Chattanooga, and she entered a treatment center there. And after she got in there, she started calling her mother and talking to her mother and confronting her mother. Well, after about 2 weeks of that, her mother announced to me that she was going to go to treatment herself. She said, I'm going to do something about my drug and alcohol problem. So I put her on an airplane. She went down to Chattanooga. Well, after she'd been there a few weeks, it was time for me to go down for family week. And I went down, and I had only been there a day, and she and a counselor confronted me, and she says, you're an alcoholic. She says, you got to go to treatment. If you don't go to treatment, we're all through. And I said, well, I didn't know I had that problem, but if that's what it takes to get you sober, I'll go to treatment. And I called my boss up, and I said, well, they tell me I'm an alcoholic, and I got to go to treatment. And he said, I didn't know you had that trouble. And I said, well, I didn't either. But I had a health insurance policy that would pay that, and I knew that I had to be an alcoholic, so I told him I was an alcoholic. And that's one of the things that I've tried to, you know, on this program, and uh,
I've wrestled with that issue, and I've come to the conclusion that I did get treatment for alcoholism, for the disease of alcoholism, because I learned a lot about Bob in that particular. I learned a lot about alcoholism and learned a lot about Bob. Well, I entered treatment down that treatment center, and I'd only been there. I was there about a week or so, and she booked in the middle of the night. I had driven down there, so in the middle of the night, she threw all of her clothes in the car and took off. And the counselors thought I'd connived with her, and when they started talking to me, I said, no, I hadn't talked to her in days. And the counselor that I had said, well, he says, I don't know if you're an alcoholic or not. He says, that's for you to make the decision. He says, but I will tell you one thing. He says, until you do something about your obsession for this woman, you're never going to get well. And this is what we do. We obsess over the alcoholics in our life. And he says, you'll hear from her, and you've got to make a decision what you're going to do. And this was kind of frightening. And so I said the first time she called, I refused to take the call. And then the next time she called, I took the call, and she says, you got to get out of that place. She says, you're not an alcoholic, and they'll just screw your mind up. And she says, I'll come and get you. And she says, if you don't leave that place, we're all through. And I said, oh, wait a minute. First you tell me I'm an alcoholic, and if I don't go to treatment, we're all through. Now you're telling me I'm not an alcoholic, and if I don't leave, we're all through. And she says, yes. And I said, this was kind of real scary for me. And I said to her, no, I'm going to stay here. And she says, well, I'm leaving you. And I said, well, you do what you need to do to take care of yourself because I'm staying here. And this was the first time I was ever able to say no to someone in a relationship. I often say I'm glad I'm not a woman. I've been pregnant all the time because I don't know how to say no. So I just was scared to death, but I stayed there. I stayed there about 5 or 6 weeks, and I got out. And when I got out, she had left my home. But since I was cured now, I went and moved her back in. And took care. She had signed a lease in some apartment, and I took care of all that and got her back in and figured that everything's going to be all right. Now, one thing, she had been going to AA. Now, one of the things that I did is that's where I beat a path to Al-Anon because I knew that's where I belonged. And that's where my adventure began in Al-Anon. And I started Al-Anon, and she was going to AA, and after several months of that, she just announced that she was leaving me, and I was comfortable with that. As I said, I'm glad that I'd like to tell you that I threw both those women out of my life, but they both left. I was talking with a fellow that I sponsored the other night, and I said, he's in somewhat of a situation like that, and I said, you know, the truth is that in my situation, I'd probably been in there trying to keep it all together and fix it with those two women, because that's the nature of our sickness, that we're in denial that we have a problem, and we think that we're powerful enough to fix those things. And as that worked out for me, I was in the program. She had left and had sued me for divorce, and I joined the program and got a sponsor and started doing the things that the program tells you to do. And my sponsor at that time said, well, he said, you don't need a her in your life. All you need, stay away from that. That's all that does is give you a problem. And if any of you think you need him or her in your life, you know, one is okay. And it's when we start thinking that we need another person in our life. As I said earlier, you know, we depend on another person to make us well, and that's sick. And so I started this adventure in Al-Anon, and my sponsor told me at that time, he says, sign up, and the International is coming up in Montreal the following year in 85, and he says, volunteer to get on a workshop and participate and stay away from the women, work the program, do it. There aren't many musts in this program, but there's a few damn betters, and so you better go to meetings and work your program and do these various things, which I did. And when the time came in 85 to go to Montreal, the flights were all screwed up that morning, and I ended up in Boston and had to change planes there and got on a plane in Boston on an airline, never heard of before or since. Weren't very many people on that airliner, and there were a few people in the back, and there was a young lady sitting next to me and with her knee in a walking cast, and I sat down alongside of her, and we began talking, and you know how anonymous we are, and I said, after we got by our introductions, I said, where are you going? She said, Boston. I said, where are you going? Montreal. That's the only place the plane was going. I said, what are you going to Montreal for? And she said, convention. I said, well, I'm going to convention. And I said, AA or Al-Anon? She said, AA. And I said, I'm one of the others. So as we started talking, and she's got her knee in a walking cast, she can't walk too well, we're talking, and I asked her where she's staying. It turns out she's staying in the same hotel I'm staying in. And I said, well, this is good. I'll spread up my alley. I'll fix this. I said, I'll get you through customs, and we'll get a wheelchair for you, and we'll get your bags, and we'll share a cab and go down to the hotel. So I said, how about that? She said, that's okay. And so that's what we did, and we got down to the hotel, and I'm staying in the floor right below her. She's staying in a suite with 10 other women from Denver, and I drop my bags off my room, and I go upstairs, and these women are all running around. They're all in a dither, as alcoholic women are. So I said, what's wrong here? I'll fix it. And that seems that they were one bed short, and there weren't any extra rooms. And I said, I got two beds in my room. And I think I had different ideas than they did. But the lady I met on the plane is my wife today. And they were very protective of her. And they did send two elderly ladies down to share my room with me. And one of them afterwards gave me a wad of cotton and said, this and the Serenity Prayer got me past your snoring. When we got married 2 years later, same little lady came to our wedding in Colorado, and she gave Camille a little box with high-powered earplugs in it. She says, remember, I slept with them first. After meeting Camille and we carried on a long-distance relationship. I was doing a lot of traveling at that time, and so anytime I had to go anywhere, it was via Denver. And we started this long-distance relationship, and that continued over a two-year period, and we became friends before we became lovers. And today, Camille is my best friend, and that's the way it was unusual in my prior relationships to have that. Same time, I learned that I can't take care of her, and even if she asked me to take care of her, I can't take care of her. She takes care of herself, and I take care of myself, when we take care of each other together. And that began, as I said, it was a two-year courtship, and finally she was offered a job in Louisville, and she came and asked me whether she should take this job. And I said, oh, yeah, you can come and live with me. And she said, well, no. She said, I lived with a man for 7 or 8 years, and I made up my mind I was never going to live with a man again unless I married him. And I said, well, I've been married to two women, two alcoholics, and I'm not about to take on a third. So we compromised and got married. So that, as I said, that our relationship, it's an adventure. And life is an adventure. And I think, you know, on a daily basis, when I start my day and I try to have a period of do a little prayer and meditation and anymore I don't say my prayers by saying God. I used to so many times starting back as a boy and at church in Michigan when I used to say, well, what is the game plan? And I would say, God, help me do something. And I would make a decision of what I needed to do, and then I'd ask God to help me. Well, today when I start my day, I say, well, God, here I am, reporting for duty. What do you got for me today? And it doesn't really matter what you got for me. It's going to be fun. It's going to be exciting. You know, Helen Keller said that life's either got to be a glorious adventure or it's nothing. And I believe it's a glorious adventure on a daily basis. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know who I'm going to see or what I'm going to do. But I know it's going to be all right. And I also know, I was thinking yesterday when we came through, drove up here, and we came through Kokomo, and I know my grandfather is buried in Kokomo. I don't know where, but I know it's somewhere in that city. I saw a graveyard and a cemetery, and I was thinking, you know, if you've ever been in a cemetery, and you look at the headstones, and it'll give the name of the deceased, and it'll give the year of birth and the year of death, and there's a little gap in between that, and that represents your life. And that's all we have, is that short time that we're here on this earth. And if we think about yesterday, at least for me, if I think about yesterday, I have feelings of guilt. And if I look at tomorrow, I get a lot of fear. And fear and guilt are two things that I don't deal with too well. So if I try to stay in the day and enjoy what I am doing today and don't spend a lot of energy on worrying about what I have to do or not what I've done in the past, and just enjoy what God has brought and will bring to me and continues to bring to me on a daily basis, it's a joyous thing. It's joyful for me to stand here today before you in South Bend, Indiana, and it's exciting. Life is exciting, and I don't know the excitement of what tomorrow's going to bring. I don't worry about it. I'm too busy living today. And where else could I be today but be here with you fine people? You're like my family. The speaker this morning was talking about family, and you are all my family. And when I get this opportunity to come and talk with you all, I just feel the being at home. And so a few years ago, after my employer of some 22 years called me in, wanted me to go to California and to do what I was doing for in Louisville, and after a while, I found out this was going to be a lateral move. So Camille and I talked about it and decided that we didn't want to go out there on that basis. And so my employer called me in and said, "Well, what we think you want to do is you want to retire." And I said, "I didn't know I wanted to retire." And he said, "Yeah." He said, "We think you want to retire. In fact, we've even set the date for you, 6 months from the day." And so the way things worked out, I went and talked to my sponsor about it, and he says, "Well, it's all a matter of ego anyway." He said, "You don't know what's going to happen, but just keep an open mind and move on." And that's the way things worked out. I had the opportunity all my life. I thought it would be fun to teach, and so I taught for a couple of years at Indiana University Southeast. I taught there for a couple of years, then I got a job working with a law firm in Louisville, and it's just, life is very exciting, and you don't know what's going to happen. And right now, Camille's gone back to school. She'll tell you about that, but I'm waiting for her to finish, get her PhD, and then I can really retire. But life is such an adventure, you know, and in this program, if we continue to do the things that we need to do to take care of ourselves, and I believe that one important thing in this program is the steps and the traditions of our program, and also the concepts, which we don't talk about much, but at least with the steps, I like to just take a moment to run through the steps, because I do that on a daily basis. At least I work the first three steps on a daily basis, and I always look at the first step. I call that acceptance, and the second step I call hope or faith, and the third step I like to call commitment. You know, and the first step we talk about acceptance and accepting the fact that we're powerless over persons, places, and things. At least we say in Al-Anon is powerless over alcohol, but I like to say we're powerless over persons, places, or things. And it says our life is unmanageable. The unmanageability of my life is a permanent thing. I've come to understand that it's a permanent thing. So that's why I need this program. I need you people. Because on a daily basis, my life is manageable if I stay connected to my higher power. And that reminds me of my higher power. I saw another bumper sticker yesterday coming up here, and it said, "If you live like there is no God, you better be right." And I thought, yeah, that's right. You get a lot of philosophy in bumper stickers. And but that second step, we say there's a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity, and that I call faith or hope. And it doesn't say who we have as our higher power, just that we have somebody greater than ourselves. I often think that there's an unwritten step between one and two, which I call like 1A, and it's that step is I'm not him. And I think that that's what gets us into a lot of problems. We don't come right out and say we're God, but we act as if we're God because we try to make these decisions for not only ourselves but for other people, and we continue to manage and manipulate, and we forget that we're not gods. And so today when I pray, I don't tell God what the game plan is. I'm the junior partner, and I just say, God, what do you got for me today? And I know it's going to be okay, and it's going to be fun. And that's the faith, and then the third step there is the commitment to turn your life and your will over to God as you understand him. And that's the commitment. You don't just do it one day and do this, work the steps once, make that commitment, forget it. I have to make that commitment on a day-to-day basis. Every day I have to turn my life and will over to the care of my God, because left to my own devices, I would surely screw my life up. Left to my own devices, I would have selected and accepted a lot less in my life than I have today. And you go on from those steps, and you take the fourth, and you do the fourth and the fifth, and the fourth step is honesty with self, and the fifth step is honesty with others. You collect the garbage in four and take it to the curb to be carried away in the fifth step, and then you get on to the sixth and seventh, which is willingness and humility. And it took me a long time to understand that with humility and just to humbly turn my life over to God. And it's not a lose situation when we do that. It's a win-win situation. Often we talk about humility in the military sense. We think it's humiliation. It's surrender. But I think in that particular step, when we surrender ourselves to our higher powers, it's a win-win situation. And we get on from that, doing the amends, and I'm not going to talk about that. We could talk about amends, but that's the thing that frees us from the chains that bind us. And we get into the 10, 11, and 12, and they talk about that as being the maintenance steps, but I don't like to call them maintenance steps because I want, for my life, I want everything imaginable. I mean, I say that not in a sense of greediness, but just I want to be able to live on a daily basis and to enjoy what God would want me to enjoy, because I believe that that's God's desire for all of his children, to enjoy life at its fullest. And so when you get into 10, 11, and 12, you get into 10, which I call persistence, when you continue to take personal inventory, and when you're wrong, promptly admit it. And then you get into 11, which is spirituality. And to me, that's what this program's all about, and it's probably the most important step for me is that step. You know, these steps only are about 250 words, and you probably can commit them to your memory much faster than you can commit them to your heart. But in that, in 1985, when I went to Montreal, Lois Wilson, who was the one of the founders of Al-Anon and the wife of Bill Wilson, she was there in one of her last public appearances, and she was some 90-some years old, and they brought her in a wheelchair, and she spoke for just a few minutes. And one of the things she said, it was a Sunday morning, and she said, this meeting has been billed as the spiritual meeting. And she says, is not that what this program is all about? And it is a program, it's a spiritual program. And you are angels. You're angels in my life, because this is where I come to hear what God would have me do in my life. And you're all prophets, whether you wish to be or not, you're all prophets in my life. And then you get to the 12th step, which I call selflessness. Because the problem, as I see it in both Al-Anon and AA, and the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic, is selfishness. We're all selfish. And one of the paradoxes of this program is you can't keep it unless you give it away. And when you get from selfishness into selflessness and are able to give it away, then you're home, and you've had that spiritual awakening, as they talk about, that through the working of the steps. And on a day-to-day basis, we could go on for all the other tools. It's a magnificent program, and I wish for all of you love, peace, happiness, and all the good things in this life, but most of all, I wish for you a desire and a want in your lives to make this program a want in your life and a working of it that will bring you all the peace and happiness that you all deserve. And if no one, again, thank you for inviting us, and thank John and Kathy for being such lovely hosts and hostesses. We've just enjoyed the fellowship and the food immensely. And I just want to thank you all for being here for us. And if no one else, if you haven't been told today that someone loves you, I love you. Thank you.